Welcome back. We're now up to about the year 500 BC in our historical narrative. And for the next four lectures, we're going to be focusing on the Mediterranean world. And the next century there is going to witness both Greece's supreme achievements and some of their very worst disasters. This century will begin with Greece coming into conflict with the most powerful state of that era, Persia. So before we can return to Greece, first we have to consider Persia. Persia was the latest and probably the greatest in our string of Mesopotamian-based Near Eastern empires that we first looked at in lectures 2 and 3. And the Persian Empire is the direct successor to the Assyrians and the Chaldeans. But the Persians had expanded their reach and power even beyond the territory of the Near East. And this makes them arguably the first great world empire. So by 500 BC, there's really no doubt that Persia was the superpower of the ancient Mediterranean and all of the ancient Near East. The borders of the Persian Empire stretched all the way from the frontier of India in the east to Greece in the west. And even the once mighty state of Egypt had now fallen under the control of the Persian Empire and was reduced to being no more than one among many of its provinces. Persia then was the largest, richest, most culturally sophisticated and powerful state that we've really yet seen. The Persian Empire was a multicultural empire. It was made up of dozens of very, very different linguistic and ethnic groups. And if you compare the vast Persian Empire to all the Greek states collectively, they would be utterly insignificant. They might amount to something like 1 to 2% of the territory of Persia, and probably a similar tiny percentage in terms of population, army, and in terms of wealth, even less. Persia was fabulously wealthy. Now, while within the Persian Empire there were many different religions, the dominant religion of the ruling class was Zoroastrianism. And, of course, its supreme deity was Ahura Mazda. Following the long-standing model of Mesopotamian states, the political structure of the Persian Empire was an absolute kingship. And the Persian king liked to call himself by the, I suppose, somewhat grand but justified title, the King of Kings. And he was regarded almost as a living god. And the sort of confidence and arrogance of these rulers is exemplified by the Behistun inscription, which we talked about in the first lecture, in which the Persian king Darius I repeatedly brags about how he's the most powerful king and has a divine right to be the supreme ruler of all the world. Actually, trying to govern this huge empire, though, was a real challenge for the Persian King of Kings. And one somewhat effective and creative strategy that the Persian used to try to unite this huge empire together was to build what was, for the time, a very advanced system of roads. And the main one of these was called the Royal Road. And this is among the very first planned network of roads. And, of course, it would facilitate communication as well as movement of armies, which is very useful when you're trying to deal with rebellions. And along these ancient highways of the Persian Empire were constantly traveling strings of messengers, and they were called the King's Eyes. In terms of administration, the Persian Empire was organized into sub-districts called satrapies. These are named after the regional governors who are called a satrap. And almost always, these guys were Persian noblemen. Each satrap was very much like a miniature King of Kings. So he was responsible for collecting taxes, commanding the local armies, and he lived in a big, luxurious palace. The biggest weakness of the Persian Empire was frequent revolt by the conquered peoples and sometimes by satraps. And it was not uncommon for there to be multiple candidates vying for the throne and for that title of King of Kings. In 500 BC, the King of Kings was the Darius of the Behistun inscription, and he had emerged as the victor in exactly one of these internal civil wars. And the story how he ended up with the throne is kind of a nice one. Supposedly there had been six rivals for the throne, and in order to avoid having a destructive civil war, the six men all agreed to let the gods pick the next king. And so they did this by gathering together before dawn, and they agreed that the first man whose horse whinnied after the sun rose would be the next king. Well, Darius's groom came up with a nice trick to ensure his candidate would win. So just after dawn, he exposed Darius's stallion to a rag that had been infused with the smell of a female horse in heat, and this, of course, naturally caused the stallion to whinny very vigorously, and so Darius became the King of Kings. The Greek Ionian cities, those cities along the coast of Asia Minor, had been conquered by Persia. But in 499, maybe influenced or encouraged by all these new ideas being formulated by the Ionian rationalists, the Ionian cities revolted against the Persian Empire to try and gain their freedom. And when they did this, they appealed for help to the cities of mainland Greece. And most of the mainland Greek cities refused. But Athens sent 20 ships to help them out. Now, initially, the Ionian revolutionaries had quite a bit of success. They even captured and burnt down Sardis, which was the capital city of the local satrap. Darius, though, eventually brought in the main army, crushed the rebellion, and restored order, although it took him a couple of years. And in the process of doing this, he became aware of the help that Athens had given to these revolutionaries. And this deeply offended him. He viewed it as foreigners meddling in internal Persian affairs. And up to this time, it seems like he had really never paid much attention to the Greeks. They were really just a insignificant, tiny race of people on the very fringes of his empire. And they were hardly worth noticing. But now, at least from his perspective, these puny little upstarts had the temerity to interfere in Persian affairs. So Darius decides he has to teach them a lesson. He gathers an army, small by Persian standards, and sends it to crush the Greeks. Now, on the Greek scale, this was a huge army. And the Persian forces landed on the mainland of Greece in 490 BC. And they camped on a level stretch of land just outside of Athens called the Plain of Marathon. One of the most influential leaders in Athens at this time was Miltiades. And he was actually from an aristocratic Ionian family who had fled to Athens as refugees trying to escape from Persia's grasp a little while previously. The Athenians realized that they needed help to try and fight the Persians. And so they sent their very fastest runner dashing down to Sparta, who of course had the best warriors, the best hoplites in Greece. And supposedly this runner ran the 150 miles from Athens to Sparta in just 2 days. Now, the Spartans were always inclined to be isolationist. So they used the excuse that they were in the middle of celebrating a religious festival to say that, we're sorry, our army really can't get there in time. This left the Athenians alone to face the mighty Persians, with only a couple other relatively minor Greek states as allies. Now, despite being so badly outnumbered, the Athenians do have the leadership of Miltiades, who really is an excellent general. And he decides their best chance was to go on the attack. So the Athenians march out, attack the Persians, fight a big battle on the plain of Marathon. And to the complete astonishment of absolutely everyone, the Athenians won a stunning victory. And this was a huge shock. Marathon counts among the most amazing military upsets in all of history. It would be equivalent to something like if today the United States were to go to war with Luxembourg, and Luxembourg were to somehow win. According to what might be a legend, the Greeks then dispatched a runner back to Athens to announce the wonderful news. And of course, he was so excited he ran as fast as he could, with the result that as soon as he'd gone to Athens and proclaimed the victory, he collapsed and died. And the distance from the battlefield of Marathon to the center of Athens was 26.25 miles. And if you've ever wondered why marathon races today are such a weird distance, now you know the reason. In the battle, only 192 Greeks were killed, in contrast to 6,400 Persians. And this is at least partially because of those hoplite warfare tactics which the Greeks are all now using and which give them a distinct advantage over the Persians, who had much lighter armor. And this statistic for the number of Persians killed at the Battle of Marathon actually seems to be a reliable ancient number, because the Athenians had sworn before the battle to sacrifice a young goat to the gods for every dead Persian. Now, their unexpected success far exceeded the number of young goats available in Athens, and so they ended up paying off their debt to the gods in a sort of annual installment plan of 500 young goats every year. While this victory was of enormous importance to the Greeks, from the Persian perspective, this was only a minor annoyance. I mean, it had been a small army by Persian standards. It really hadn't been an all-out effort. But to defend the image of Persia and of the King of Kings, it was clear to Darius that he would now have to send another army to smite the Greeks utterly and really to show them who was boss. That next Persian invasion, though, is delayed for a full 10 years. Various things distract the King of Kings, Egypt revolts, and Darius himself dies. And this sparks yet another round of civil war to see who would be the next King of Kings. So Athens and Greece get a crucial 10-year breathing space in which they can prepare for the return of the Persians. Now, everybody knows the Persians are coming back, and they know that this time Persia will come with its full force and will be looking to get revenge. In this intervening period, Athens has another stroke of luck, because right around this time, they discover a particularly rich silver mine. And initially, Athens had planned to simply take the income from those mines and distribute it equally among all the citizens, sort of like a dividend. But an Athenian leader named Themistocles, who was completely obsessed with the idea that Athens had to get ready for the next Persian invasion, gives a whole bunch of speeches, and he manages to persuade the Athenians instead to invest that money in building a fleet of 200 warships. These are known as triremes. And a trireme was a very long, narrow ship. It's propelled by about 100 guys pulling oars, and it has about 20 hoplites on it. And the main battle tactic of these ships was to smash into an enemy ship with a big bronze ram that projected from the front of the trireme. Themistocles, by the way, was a little bit obsessive about this whole need to get ready for Persia's return, to such a degree that when he has a daughter born during this period, the name he inflicts on this poor girl was the phrase, "Remember the war," in Greek. This was also the period when ostracism gets instated at Athens, and the most frequently appearing name on ostraca is Themistocles himself, even though he seems to have avoided ever being the top vote getter and so he's able to remain at Athens. Miltiades, the hero of Marathon, is not so lucky, and he finds himself being put up and prosecuted on charges that are really trumped up. They accuse him of deceiving the people. And they have a long trial for him, and it drags on and on. And in the end, the trial never reaches a conclusion because just before it had begun, he had suffered an injury, and that wound becomes gangrenous, and he died, which is really a kind of inglorious end to someone who is a true Athenian hero. Finally, in 480 BC, the long-awaited event happens. The Persians come back. The new king of kings is named Xerxes, and this time he arrives leading his army in person. And this was plainly an enormous force. Our ancient sources say 1 million men. Now, that's almost certainly an exaggeration. But without doubt, it was big, and it was many, many, many times larger than all the Greeks combined. This Persian juggernaut comes rolling down from the north, and the northern Greek states are quickly captured. In this emergency situation, the Greeks turn to their long-standing source of advice whenever confronted with some sort of disaster, and they send a delegation to the Delphic Oracle to seek the advice of the gods. And initially, they aren't very encouraged when the delegation enters the temple and the priestess who actually delivers the oracles responds by screaming, "Run away to the ends of the earth," and then she runs out of the temple. The delegation, though, sat down in the temple and said, "We're not going to leave until we get a better oracle." So finally, the priestess comes back and gives them a second oracle. And the second one is, "Trust in the wooden walls." And after receiving this rather ambiguous advice, they leave. And nobody can quite figure out what this prophecy meant. So for a while, they just ignore it. Meanwhile, northern Greece has been captured by the Persians. But to get down into central and southern Greece, the Persian army has to come through a narrow mountain pass called Thermopylae. And this presents an opportunity for the Greeks. In that narrow funnel formed by the pass, it doesn't matter how many Persians there are, because only a few can fit in there to fight at any one time. So they decide to fight the Persians at Thermopylae. And this is a pretty good plan when you're severely outnumbered. Unfortunately, a local shepherd reveals to the Persians a sort of secret path that gets around and will allow them to come up behind the Greeks. So Xerxes immediately sends his elite regiment, a group of 10,000 men called the Immortals. And they're called that because there's never a vacancy in their ranks. And they go around that secret path to attack the Greeks from behind. The Greeks see them coming, and they know they're going to be trapped, so they have to retreat. But somebody has to stay behind to hold off the Persians long enough for everybody else to escape. Now, the Spartans had suffered a little bit of shame for the last 10 years because they had failed to participate in the great victory at Marathon. So now, the Spartan king, Leonidas, promptly volunteers that he and his 300 Spartans will hold the pass, even though they're almost certain to be killed. And a famous image of bravery is this small band of 300 Spartans left behind, waiting for the Persians to come attack. And as they wait for battle, as is their tradition, they carefully comb each other's hair and they rub scented oils into it. And when the attack finally begins, the Persians fire so many arrows that supposedly one Spartan says to another, "Look, there's so many arrows, they're blocking out the sun." And in what's a perfect display of Spartan bravado, the second Spartan just says, "Well, good, then we can fight in the shade." The Spartans do manage to heroically hold off the Persians long enough for all the other Greeks to escape. But in the end, they're overwhelmed, and they're all killed. Nevertheless, the Battle of Thermopylae, becomes famous as maybe the classic example of Spartan bravery. The Persians then come down into central Greece, and the Greeks are forced to keep giving ground and retreat. And even Athens has to be abandoned. So the Persians sack and burn the city. Now at this point, there's the debate heats up about how to interpret that Delphic oracle about the wooden walls. Some people say they should build a big wooden wall across the narrow isthmus of Corinth and maybe fight from behind it. But Themistocles at this point says, I know what the wooden walls mean. This means we should rely on those ships that we had built with the money from the silver mine, and we should fight the Persians at sea. So he persuades the Greek fleet to gather together near an island called Salamis, and here he hopes to repeat that Thermopylae strategy, since even though the Persian fleet outnumbers the Greek, only a small number of ships could enter the straits between Salamis and the mainland at any one time. So it's a Thermopylae on the waves. In the ensuing Battle of Salamis, the Greeks once again score an upset, shocking victory, and they sink a lot of the Persian navy. Now, the land army's still there, but with the loss of those ships, the Persians can no longer bring enough supplies to feed them. So Xerxes, along with most of the army, is forced to go back to Persia. Well, after this defeat of the second Persian invasion in 480, Greece now is left with a new sense of the power that they have when they act with unity. The combined naval strength of Athens, the land army of Sparta, and the contributions from all the other Greek states had proven to be a powerful military force. Despite all these victories, Persia is still the great superpower. I mean, the core of their empire is completely untouched. So the Greek states now join together to form what we would call a mutual defense league. And this alliance is called the Delian League because it has its treasury located on the sacred island of Delos. And this is where delegates from each of the members would come together to hold their meetings. The Delian League begins as a union of equals. Each Greek state has one vote, and all of them contribute money or ships as they're able to the treasury. To seal the agreement, all the members of the Delian League swear a solemn oath, and then they throw lumps of iron into the sea. And this signifies that they'll never break this agreement until those lumps rise from the water, which, of course, is impossible. As the state with by far the biggest navy, Athens naturally assumes somewhat of a leadership role in military campaigns, even though technically all states have equal status in the league structure. After the Persian Wars, Sparta has gone back to Sparta and retreated into its usual policy of isolationism, and so they never actually even joined the league at all. Soon, though, that Greek unity, which has brought these spectacular successes against Persia, starts to erode and break down. So, for example, in a famous incident in 467 BC, the island of Naxos says that, well, since it looks like the threat from Persia is gone, we want to withdraw from the Delian League. But Athens won't let them. And Athens now blockades the island of Naxos, forcing them to surrender. Naxos is reinstated as a member of the League, but with the crucial change that from then on, they're disarmed. And instead of supplying troops or ships, they pay tribute money to the League's treasury. Now, this incident sets an unfortunate precedent. It shows that Athens will use military force against its own allies. And it also starts a trend that other states pay money, and that money now gets used by Athens to build up its own military forces. So what starts out as a mutual defense league of equals is slowly transformed into what we call the Athenian Empire, in which subject states are forced to pay tribute money to Athens. And the new reality of the Athenian Empire is made very, very clear to everyone when Athens finally drops any pretense at all that Delos is the center of the league, when they move the treasury from the neutral territory of Delos to Athens itself. Another indication that Athens was now more afraid of its own subject states than any foreigners is the fact that Athens constructs a series of walls. These are called the Long Walls, and they connect Athens to its port of Piraeus, a couple miles away. And this act ensures that as long as the Athenian fleet can control the sea, no enemy could surround Athens and starve it into submission. Even though Athens is still a democracy, there are leaders in the city, and Athens at this time flourishes under the influence of a particularly wise politician named Pericles. He's the one who guides the Athenian Empire to great political success and economic prosperity. And the mid-5th century BC is a time that we refer to as the Golden Age of Classical Athens. This is a time when Pericles directs a lot of that tribute money towards cultural endeavors. And Athens embarks on a frenzied building program, building temples and subsidizing sculptors and artists. And a lot of the greatest achievements in Greek sculpture, architecture, and theater take place during this era. And we'll look at some of these culture achievements in the next two lectures. Athens' behavior, though, is becoming more and more arrogant and really openly imperialistic. And so the other Greek states, naturally, are beginning to get quite resentful. There's a whole series of little incidents that have ratcheted up the tension between Athens and particularly Sparta. And as a result of this, a loose coalition of Greek states centered around Sparta forms in opposition to Athens. And that group is called the Peloponnesian League. If we look at the atmosphere in Greece in the 440s and 430s BC, it's really reminiscent of the Cold War in the 1950s and 60s. So instead of NATO in the Warsaw Pact, the Greek world is divided between the Athenian and the Peloponnesian Leagues. And while there's no overt fighting between Athens and Sparta, there's a lot of tension, and there's little skirmishes between their allies and their proxies. Also, just like the Cold War, is the fact that there are dramatic ideological differences between the two leagues. Athens not only is a democracy, but they're constantly trying to export democracy, to encourage it in other states, and to back democratic factions in other countries. Sparta, on the other hand, believes in oligarchy, rule by a few, and so they encourage and support oligarchies in other states. So often a neutral city will find itself the scene of a kind of indirect battle between Athens and Sparta, with Athens backing an internal faction in favor of democracy, and Sparta doing the same for those who favor oligarchy. There develops a general feeling that as each side trespasses on the other's spheres of influence, that war is inevitable, although when and where it'll break out, nobody really knows. And war will indeed come between Athens and Sparta, and it will have disastrous results for everyone. But before we look at that rather grim topic, I want to pause for two lectures to examine a much more pleasant subject, the wonderful cultural achievements of Greek civilization in the 5th century. And this is the high point of Greek civilization. So it's an appropriate place to stop and consider some of their advances in sculpture, architecture, theater, and philosophy. Thank you.